Welcome to Futile Podcast tonight. It's Zach and it's Ian.
Team Alpha.
Team Alpha together again for the first time in 2015. How's your 2015 been? We celebrated it,
dude,
with some of our family and friends together.
That's right. Yeah, it was a good time. There, you didn't have enough dry firewood, but other than that.
Right, because I had a whole house that was warm with music and food, but everyone wanted to go stand outside in a smoldering fire, literally inside of the fire, huddled together like it was some kind of post-apocalyptic
thing. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Yeah. A what?
Even though the biblical tale of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Have you at least heard the Beastie Boys song?
No, I am completely
unfamiliar. You're not up on your Bible.
Or Beastie Boys.
Oh, okay.
Which one should I be more ashamed of? I don't know.
Well, I mean, in this day and age, probably Beastie Boys.
Probably, yeah.
I don't think anyone's going to begrudge you not boning up on, it's Daniel. You know Daniel in the Lion's Den? You ever heard of that?
No.
Never heard of Daniel in the Lion's Den?
The Lion's Den?
Yeah.
Which is it? This
Nebuchadnezzar threw Daniel into the lion's den.
Okay.
And
this sounds like some old school stuff.
Yeah, it's the Old Testament.
Right.
And he said, "Sorry, I have to do this," And so I don't remember why. And then they opened up the lion's den later, expecting the lions ate them all up, and Daniel was fine. And the lions weren't eating him.
He tamed the lions.
No, because God protected him from the lions. So later on, he's got some young guys he's bringing up under him.
Right.
Right, teach him how to be priests or whatever. Or something like that. And they're Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Okay.
And
these are like the disciples of Daniel?
They're not really disciples. They're just buddies of his.
Okay.
And the king, once again...
This is Nebuchadnezzar again?
Yeah, either him or his son. You ever heard the phrase "the writing on the wall"?
Yeah, right.
That's also from a Daniel story. I'll get to that one next.
Okay.
So the king's soothsayers and stuff are like, "Hey, you gotta make sure that no one's praying to the Jewish God, the Israelite God. Then what you want them to pray to you or whatever, you pray to your gods." And so they're like, "You need to make a law that if anyone's not praying to you or the they're praying to the Israelite God instead, then you're going to kill him." And he's like, fine. He keeps doing it, geez. All right,
he's begrudgingly doing these
things. Yeah, and so he signs off on it. And this time, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego get caught. And, praying to the Israeli God. And the Hebrew God, I should say. And so they throw those guys in a furnace. A huge burning furnace.
What they did to Freddy?
Exactly. Just like they're all wearing striped sweaters. And then when they look inside the furnace, they don't see three people. They see three figures, but they also see a fourth figure. The fourth figure was an angel of the Lord protecting Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Anyway, they came out unscathed from the furnace, and Nebuchadnezzar once again was like, "Oh man, crazy! You guys are great. Your God's great." And then
he converted then.
At some point, I think he might have. Right. And then his son was king later, and Daniel was still kicking. He was older at this point, but he was still kicking. And the son was the new king threw a major feast, and there was lots of gluttony and wanton behavior,
debauchery.
Debauchery. And suddenly, a giant hand appeared and drew some letters on a wall. Handwriting on the wall, and he called all his people over, all the soothsayers and magic men and philosophers, and said, "What does that say?" And they couldn't. No one could read it. No one could read it at all. And so finally, he called Daniel over, and Daniel read it, and it said,
"Is it eating an hors d'oeuvre?" Oh, right, yeah. That's.
No, and so he told him that it said it was something about how this king and all his people were. That was the end of the road for them. And then, the next day, they were secretly invaded by an army that crushed the whole, Anyway.
Dang.
That's the story of Daniel. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is also a great Beastie Boys song off of Paul's Boutique.
Nice.
And I think the only reason why they came to that was because there was three of them, and there was three Beastie Boys. So you, right. see how it works?
I see it.
I think that's the way their minds worked when they were writing songs.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Three MCs and we're on the go. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they rhyme go with go. It's also kind of bothersome to me. But, you know, what are you going to do? 1989.
Yeah, they're learning. They're cutting some slack. They'll cut their baby teeth. At least they weren't biting rhymes, right?
Yeah, they weren't biting rhymes for sure. They bit their own rhymes quite a bit.
Well, yeah.
And they also bit, you know, like Run DMC. So yeah, they bit a lot of rhymes.
Ooh.
All right, so what were we talking about?
Good point. We're talking about 2015 and the celebration of the new year and what you've seen and what you appreciated about this year, about 2014. And this can be our year in review because, I mean, we watched Glimmer Man with Seth, but maybe we'll wait till we can get Seth on and do more comprehensive.
He'll never be on this again.
Some Friday we'll have him on for a comprehensive. And we'll just start hammering him out. Because he, you know who he is. He'll all of a sudden remember stuff from the other one. He's better, I think, when he's had more time to marinate on it.
Recall.
Yeah.
He has drunk recall. And he wasn't drunk tonight.
Right.
So how's he going to remember? Drunk recall only works if you were drunk at the time.
I don't know. We'll see. We'll have to test it. Anyway, so 2014 came in like the way years always start. Lame in January. Dark and who cares. And then we had some comic book movies. It was really only Guardians of the Galaxy.
I don't remember what came out this last year at all.
Yeah, it's kind of uneventful, I suppose.
I want to say Grand Budapest Hotel came out.
Yeah, and I heard that was good.
That's very good. You haven't seen it yet?
No, I haven't.
It was really fun.
I like that when he has fun with his movies. I think he can do stuff that's got kind of little, like authentic character moments, too. I think he overcorrected maybe in... And Darjeeling versus something like Royal Tenenbaums where like there's moments that are kind of dire and like near suicide attempt stuff happens, but there's also
Darjeeling is like
funny
constant
stuff.
Dire and yeah. Like that one was like it wasn't dark but
there was not a lot of
just leaned toward
yeah.
And you know you still have to see it, but in Grand Budapest it's like the tone is so much lighter but it still goes into some pretty dark stuff.
Well, yeah.
But it's hilarious. It's by far its funniest film in a long
time.
Well,
even like Life Aquatic is like an adventure movie and stuff, but there's moments where it's like, they killed that guy. Okay.
But you know, the artistry of a director, the aesthetics of a director can cover up stuff that's like, you know, I always think about in Life Aquatic what he did with the Willem Dafoe character, who's like, he's just in it like scowling here and there, and then he punches out what's his name,
Goldblum,
Owen Wilson,
and
says something to him scowling, and then later he has that thing where he's like, Steve Zissou, you know, picks him to go lead another team. He's like, thanks. Thanks for never choosing me. And he like starts to get all upset. And then later he explains to him, like, the reason I never picked you was because I knew you could handle your own team.
Yeah.
And he's like, thank you. Like, you know, so there's their entire character arc in like, he probably has 10 words in the movie and like 5 individual shots.
Yeah.
Where he's basically like, you know, like, so there's stuff like that in there. And it's almost like it's there as a joke. And it is played for humor. But it's also got like emotional resonance to
sure.
Like this is somebody who's like butthurt about this man he admires and loves kind of casting him off because of this new guy coming in. But it's just it's fascinating to see how he crafts stuff that's really like throw off stuff. Like almost a lot of his movies are just made off of like a whole compilation of throw off material,
right.
And then he just drapes this artistry over it.
Yeah,
that just makes it all work. I mean, he's a fascinating director.
Yeah, he can get away with things other directors can't, like a Tarantino kind of.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, just
they're somewhere in there like that. Have you seen? Did you watch the new P.T. Anderson yet?
No, have you?
No, I probably could, but
Inherent Vice. I haven't been looking. I should look.
I don't think it's out in locally yet.
Locally, I'm sure it will be. Probably sometime in late January or February, we will see it. We will review it. We reviewed Llewellyn Davis. We made good.
Llewellyn. I thought it was Llewellyn also. I said Llewellyn many, many times, but it's Llewellyn.
Okay. I think I got it right at the beginning and you corrected me today.
I overcorrected. I was wrong. You were right. First time and last time I'll ever say that.
So 2015 begins. Mm-hmm. We got, what do we got? We got the end of the Lord of the Rings Hobbit movies. kind of closed it out. That was what I saw recently.
How'd that go for you?
I'd heard mostly kind of middling, like, not so great, whatever, you know. And I've sort of felt that way about the movies. Mm-hmm. And it's more than just, I think, the fact that it's a smaller and a kind of a different sort of story. I mean, along with the fact that it's got the prequel problem, it just is a smaller story. It's just not as big. It's the stakes are not as high. I mean, so it's hard to it's hard for it to be as good as Lord of the Rings. It just isn't going to be, if you're trying to compare them on the same way. And because they tried to make them like
that's why he shouldn't have made them that way.
Yeah, and in the first movie, to its credit, there is a lot of kind of more fun, singing, dancey stuff. And as it goes, it becomes less about Bilbo and more about the other elves and this other storyline they've sort of padded out with things. And I felt like, I like this one. The third one, I liked it more than the second one. I think the second one probably felt to me like I had the most padding. There was a lot of time in Lake Town I just didn't care. Almost everything with Stephen Fry, I'm sorry, Stephen Fry has done amazing good stuff. I mean, nothing I can cite specifically that I can't
remember. The movie about Oscar Wilde.
Sure, which I haven't seen in a million years.
He was Jeeves.
Yeah, I know that too, but I haven't seen that in long enough that I can't really say, like, that's good. So
he's spectacular as Jeeves.
I know he was
good as the bumbling inspector in Gosford Park.
Okay, I could see. He's good. But, and it wasn't even that character. It was, well, I mean, there was interesting stuff in that whole idea of, like, this town that, like, what are you going to do if you create this menace of this dragon and everything? And then the way they framed it by having that be like the big cliffhanger ending, rather than actually maybe concluding that at the end of the movie, might have been a bad call on their part. But I don't know, because then it ends up being it's almost like a TV show. At some point, you go into the third movie and it's like, you know, Sansa previously on. You're like, oh wait, oh that's right, and then he's tied up, and okay, right, yeah, and this. And I feel like there's even towards like the credit of having everything flow real well, I feel like they made some sort of obvious just differences in choices, like the way that they did credits or the way that they did like the way that they ended things and stuff with credits doesn't quite work. I mean, I like
talking about credits now.
Talking about because that stuff is what you end up amounting to because you have to look at it as a bigger piece, you know. I think it as a bigger piece.
Talking about the credit sequence at the end of the film.
Yeah, I liked parts of it, but it was just different than.
You liked parts of the credit sequence at the end of the film
because it was cool drawings. It was like drawings of stuff. I liked that stuff as a kid because I actually read the books as a kid. I saw the original cartoon as a kid. I have like a lot of nostalgia for. I rewatched the cartoon before I went into this movie because I mean I still put that the cartoon is like 77 minutes. And it hits everything that is major in the story in that time.
It's
a little, I mean, there's a little bit of rushiness to it. I mean, it could have been like 90 minutes probably and fleshed out a few things a little more and whatnot. But it hits all the points pretty effectively. And it's got the songs and it's fun.
I always liked that. And I always really liked the Ralph Bashy Lord of the Rings.
Right, rotoscoped.
Which goes through about like 3/4 of the way through. The Two Towers is where it ends, I want to say.
No, I thought that too for years.
But it doesn't.
But there's two movies. He did finish the story.
He didn't do
well, I think there's a second. There is a second animation. I don't know if he just didn't do it or if it just came about later and was super low budget. But I'm pretty sure that they finished it. Yeah, so anyway, I like the third one better than the second one. I think anyone going into it without knowledge of the book, like I had and from the cartoon, that doesn't know like a major event that's going to conclude fairly early in the story, and it's going to be like, oh, well, I guess the biggest thing that's going to happen has happened. Now it's just stuff that seems smaller. It's the Steven Seagal thing, you know. You if you take out the big heavy early on, I mean, like I'm dancing around. Like anyone doesn't realize that what kind of spoiler I'm mentioning, but. Then that's...
Who hasn't read The Hobbit?
I don't know. There's a bunch of people that went and saw Lord of the Rings and were like, at the end of it, were like, what? Wasn't that the big thing? It was a bunch of disappointed people?
No.
Kind of, sort of, or something? They didn't understand that this was a bigger story? Okay, well, fine. Anyway, so when they kill the dragon 10 minutes into the end of the third movie, you're kind of like, what? And then it becomes a very different, much darker kind of story, which is true to the way The Hobbit... Even the cartoon, I remember as a kid being like, It was the first time the romance of war, even though they had sing songs and adventure, because it has that aspect of it in the cartoon, you know. And like as a kid growing up in the woods, I'm like, yeah, I could go da 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 and go outside and play and have that kind of imagination thing in your head for a bit. But then the idea of like, yeah, and then it gets serious and people get hurt and people die. And,
what you have to do as soon as your kid is old enough to, like, before they know how to read, you show them the first battle scene from Braveheart. And then you go, this is what war is.
Right. Yeah.
This is what war is.
Right.
Or like the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan.
That would work, yeah.
Right? And then never again will they play war.
Sure, possibly, yeah. Anyway, but it's not even the idea of glamorizing war. That's not really what's going on in the story. It's the idea of the adventure outside of your home. And then it kind of comes full circle. And they kept that line. I don't know if it's from the... It must be from the book, because it was in the cartoon, and they kept it in the third movie when Thorin dies, and he says, if more people valued home over gold, a merrier place it would be. This would be. And that's like a really kind of meaningful, like, you just want to settle. And I think there's a good story there about, like, people that go out, they sow their wild oats, they have their adventures, but they kind of appreciate what they have, too, and then they get home and they appreciate it even more, whatever. And it hit on some of that, but it was much less Bilbo's story. It really was just mostly a bunch of fights, and the geography and the topography had interesting aspects for set pieces, but it became kind of confused and muddled too. And just was kind of, I don't know, you're just kind of waiting for something of substance to happen and kind of waiting for it to be over. And it was kind of like a foregone, like I saw it to, you know, to have seen them all.
Even so, from my first memory of reading The Hobbit, or having The Hobbit read to me maybe even earlier, was that it was small scale, and that it was something that in this world it ends with a big battle and this field and there's the mountain over there and all this stuff,
right?
But that it was just a battle. And
And it was about, it was the idea of this greed and these different people laying claim to it and having rationale for it.
That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about
is... But it has an allegorical quality to it, though.
Then, yeah, but this was his... He wrote this. It was a YA book. It was a 300-page YA book. I don't even think it's 300 pages. It's probably less than that.
I'm not so sure.
And he... Anyway, like, it was like... It's lightweight compared to... The thing about The Lord of the Rings that makes it so that... Once again, this is going back to why make this a three-movie thing, The Lord of the Rings a three-movie thing. The Lord of the Rings is three books. And he did most of that... He did that justice. He did those books justice. And there's tremendous stakes in Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah.
And tremendous depth of emotional and, you know... The work... You know, there isn't a single character who's worth... And motivations aren't called into question, and what really matters to them, and so forth. And The Hobbit's not the book of The Hobbit is not that. It really is a whimsical adventure thing that ends in a big battle. And it may be allegorical to a certain level, but the point is that the stakes aren't that high.
Right.
Like, it's not the entire earth. And he hadn't developed this mythology and this world to that point yet. But he used that as a jumping off point. So to go back and take this thing that's really lightweight compared to this massive thing he created later on, and then treat it the same way that you treated those movies, just, it was as asinine.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty much the definition.
And so to end up padding it, they padded it with action sequences, and they padded it with characters that didn't exist and comedy that didn't need to be in it. Like, they padded it with things that were irrelevant. The Lord of the Rings series, like, there's really no padding, very little, because all he did was draw out what actually happened in the books. But, like, I mean, if you think about, like, you take an actual, how many pages a book is, and we're like, oh, I'm gonna make this, you know, you're cutting tons and tons and tons out of a book to make a movie out of. And he didn't really do that for Lord of the Rings movies, which is why they're so long.
Extended cuts and everything, yeah.
So he just did them. he just did them the way they were supposed to be done. He did them a service, you know? And in this, I just don't see how you can go from that and doing it so well to then feeling okay with going back and taking this little thing
right.
and turning into 3 2.5 hour long yeah. movies.
And I still can't speak to it because, like, I guess there are extended editions of those. And
are you think so?
And I'm like,
there have to be. Right?
Yeah, but it's almost like it needs to go the other way, you know? Like, if the extended edition has scenes that are more true to the original Hobbit story, it's almost like, how about you don't do an extended, you do like a reduced, and you keep those
yeah,
scenes, you know? more scenes with Bilbo hemming and hawing about things or whatever. Yeah, so I mean, I agree with you. That's pretty much how it is. It's an overinflated, but still very competently made, and everything else. I mean, it's still
yeah. He's not going to make you know.
It's still good. It's just not great.
Peter Jackson is now gone back and forth between things that just like there was a while when I wanted to love him when I was younger, especially because of his horror films. But then, you know, he's had some really bloated flops. And I don't think, like, I liked a lot of the stuff in King Kong. A lot of the stuff really even stuck with me. Like, the things with the giant bugs, like, that stuff is still, it's, like, just creepy and horrifying to think about, the scenes that happen in that. And then, like, slowly eating these men, and, like, a couple of them are characters you kind of grow to learn and like on the voyage. And then, like, a lot of the fight stuff with King Kong and then the dinosaurs and stuff like that was awesome, but it's still just King Kong, which is kind of lame.
Yeah,
in my
right.
opinion. And also it was 3 hours long. So like I didn't see the Lovely Bones. I heard it wasn't that good. I don't know.
Right. I think he says he's gonna transition into smaller stuff now or mm-hmm. for a while or whatever. Who knows? Anyway, that puts that to rest. 2014 is the end of the Lord of the Rings. 2015 is gonna be some kind of crazy year for more comic book movies and Star Wars. It's going to end with Star Wars. And that's an interesting one. Yep, you said it.
I watched...
You watched some more... You've been watching Clone Wars and stuff, right?
Yeah. I wasn't going to talk about Star Wars, but thanks for trying to shoehorn that in. I watched They Came Together. The last David Wayne.
Right, like it's a parody of rom-coms.
Fantastic.
I've heard it's pretty good.
It's like a true Zucker and Abrams parody. It's
oh, really?
Fantastic. Yes, it's fantastic.
I definitely...
It was awesome. There's like... And it's like, you know, it's got... It's like... Wet Hot American Summer is great. But I feel like at that time, they hadn't honed their comedy chops for a movie yet to the point where
yeah, yeah as a movie
the stuff that was supposed to be mocking something that was like maudlin and like teenager emotional actually came off a lot as maudlin and teenager emotional like a lot of the way through it, and this doesn't have any of that. It's like it's just pure jokes and really inventive stuff. There's some really inventive stuff, and the parody stuff is great. And it's done with, like, great actors that you see and you love and you know.
Is it three-dimensional humor, though? Like the Zucker stuff? Where the guy in the background opens up the tower thing and then pulls his laundry out?
There is stuff like that.
Okay, yeah. See, does that there's, that's the thing you... Or the giant phone in Top Secret? Or the giant shoe in Top Secret?
There's some gag stuff, but a lot of it's just... What I mean is that, like, it's a true parody. It's
right.
Not,
yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah. It was really good. I enjoyed it. And I put off watching it for a long time because I was just like, who wants to see a parody of romantic comedies? But it was great. I liked it a lot.
A funny movie sometimes just what you need. I keep trying to find that, and I keep missing because, you know, you hit something and then you're like, oh, this is turning out to be more of a dramedy than a just straight up laughing at it funny movie. But that isn't always a bad thing. Sometimes if that's done well, that can be okay, I guess. Yeah, I've been watching a lot of movies. When I watched the first part of the Three Musketeers movies. You know how they did the two of them? The Three Musketeers and the Four Musketeers?
What are you talking about?
In the 70s, with Charlton Heston.
70s, nobody watched
Oliver
those.
Reed, and directed by Richard Lester.
The only Three Musketeers that matters is the one with Oliver Platt.
And Kiefer.
Top billing, Oliver Platt.
And Kiefer.
Charlie Sheen, not Kiefer.
Charles, and Chris O'Donnell.
Chris O'Donnell.
And isn't Tim Curry in that?
Tim Curry.
And it's your boys. It's All for One and One for Love, right? Yeah. It was Rod and Sting.
And Brian Adams.
And Brian Adams.
The blonde guys. The blonde boys. The blonde bad boys of the early 90s soft rock scene.
There you go. Right, yeah. I never saw that movie.
Rebecca De Mornay. What? Are you serious? You never saw it?
Not all of it. We were watching it one time at like a
one of Delphi,
like a pizza party on like a half day at school one time, and it was getting really exciting, it was like time to go home.
It's
and
one they of those turned cool, it off. Like when Disney decided they were going to make like
PG live hard PG films. Adventure
yeah.
movies.
Yeah, it's sweet, dude. It's a sweet movie.
I think it's somewhere online. Well, but you know what? Amazon and all it does. Is they'll give you they give you the first taste is free, right. So like the first
so you watch the first 20 minutes of Three Musketeers and it makes you want to pay.
No, you watch the first movie of the Three Musketeers and you're like, this is a lot. It's mostly very comedic. I remember watching it as a kid and when I was a kid, even more so now than now, which is hard to believe. I took my heroic adventure stuff very seriously, and when like the main character when the main character is like kind of goofbally and things are more about like, I mean, it's Richard Lester, it's, you know, Hard Day's Night and Help and stuff, Superman 3. Mm-hmm. So it's got a lot of those goofy set piece things, and that's what most of the action kind of ends up being. So it really is more of a comedy than like a action adventure, but it's still got like good production value and stuff, and the plot is kind of hard to follow. It ends up being about like helping, they end up like doing something to help the queen pretend that she's not having an affair with the prime minister of England, which is like not very noble. It's not, but whatever. I don't know. That's what made me think maybe the sequel raises the stakes, and it looks like everyone's still in it. Charlton Heston, everyone. It's like he made them together or something, you know? So then I'm like, oh man, maybe they got the Four Musketeers on here. They do, but it's not free with Prime.
No.
Just like Color of Money is not free with Prime, but Hustler is. I think that they've gotten wise to that. They're like, oh, let's do the part
they're
one.
Not, they're not that wise because no one except for you and maybe two other people that have been like, oh man, now that I saw that 1973 Musketeers, I gotta watch.
This is 1974. Yeah, follow up. It leads you right into it. It shows you clips from it at the end of the other one. Like it's just a natural progression. Like they just made both movies.
Talking crazy, man.
Yeah. Anyway, it was fun. I liked it, kind of. I mean, it was like a fun Sunday afternoon movie that you kind of have on when you're distracting yourself with, I don't know, Twitter or whatever else a little too. Not every scene holds your attention, even though it's got some cool side gag stuff. Watched a couple more Bond movies.
You went through a spy movie.
An espionage movie. I tried to because I woke up one day when I was still sort of sick. And I watched You Only Live Twice, mm-hmm. which has just got... I love the set design. Mm-hmm. I love... Because it's like still big cameras, so you have to just... Everything has to be built and framed. I mean, similar to like The Musketeers or something. You had to just frame things up a certain way. And so like, yeah, there's cool like stuff on like rooftops and on a dock. And the music is awesome. And I mean, and it's got a screenplay played by Roald Dahl. Who, James the Giant Peach. I don't know if it's based on a book or not, so I don't know if Ian Fleming came up with the Hollowed Out Volcano Base or if Roald Dahl came up with the Hollowed Out Volcano Base. But that's awesome. And yeah, people can view it now and they can talk about like the racism and blah blah blah, but I don't know. To me, it doesn't seem like it's overtly saying anything about that in the story. It seems to be like that's just kind of incidental. So I don't find it terribly offensive or anything.
It's a book.
Oh, cool.
It's funny.
Cool. Yeah. So I got that was the guy that got me started on an espionage kick because I kind of always liked like a good sort of 60s, 70s kind of spy movie if I can think of the right type of one. So I just searched through what I had on the different streaming things and I found one with Walter Matthau from the 80s called Hopscotch, which was a different kind of spy movie. It was like the ex-CIA guy just runs the CIA around because he's like writing a tell-all memoir and publishing it in chapters and sending it to like the Kremlin and sending it to Langley and stuff. So that was kind of fun and kind of different. In that like post-70s cynical filmmaker kind of, you know, way where it's like, oh, look at how we're making fun of the CIA and their goofiness and stupidity and the way that they do things now and all that. And then I watched This Bio Came In From the Cold with Richard Burton, black and white, one of the John Le Carre stories, which
Le Carre?
I don't know. Is that really how you say it?
Yeah, if there's an accent.
Like then you, you drag it?
E, then you have to, yeah.
Like La Jetée?
Did you ever take any Latin?
No. Latin's a dead language. I should have, because then I know how to speak properly.
Okay, but anyway, the accent in Latin is called a macron, and whatever, you know, it you're supposed to drag out a letter, or the emphasis, it's just like the, whatever they call it, tilde or whatever, in Spanish that's different, for like over the N or whatever.
Was it Ñ?
That's a tilde. But in pretty much all foreign languages, whatever there's an accent over is the syllable that you put emphasis of the word on. Right? And in English, we don't do that, so it's more difficult. They actually mispronounce a lot of stuff more in English than in other languages because they spell it out for you, so to speak.
Mm. Anyway, black and white, set in the sort of legitimate Cold War, East and West Berlin.
I like that one.
Yeah, it's... It plays a lot more like, in some ways, it's partially like a, like in the way like a, like the burnout hitman story where he finds the girl and he's kind of, you know, it's almost like kind of a romance a little bit. It has elements of that, but it's still very much so also about this sort of crime thing, and then it's, you know, it's fairly cynical in its own way, and Burton is very good at being
that
cynical.
That was one of the ones he did where Le Carre did, at least, where it was much more of like a movie story, because it was like the romance thing and the thing about getting across the border at the end and all that stuff. And his other spy stuff is like he got way more in depth about the politics and the bureaucracy. And that was like, he was the first guy who really did that sort of thing. That was really interesting, you know. Yeah. But yeah, that was like that was a very early novel of his, I think.
Probably. And so that was that. I think that sort of ended it for me. I couldn't find much else or anything that readily struck me. I was really hoping they'd have like the Ipcris movies, you know, with Michael Caine.
Yeah. Did you watch Tinker?
No, I hadn't seen that yet either. I kept hoping that'd be on somewhere, and it's not.
So, have you seen the
original with Al Guinness?
The Indonesian. No, that's good.
I've heard that's pretty good.
I watched it when I was younger, and I don't remember much of it because, like, that new one, I think it was probably better because, like, it takes something that's really drawn out and compresses it into what you need to know.
Right.
At times, it's a little confusing, but. And then he did a sequel, the same TV thing. BBC people did called Smiley's People. That one was pretty good.
Right. Well, that character is in like a lot of them. The character's in Spy Who Came In From the Cold.
He's in most of his. Yeah, he was like his main protagonist guy.
Right. Which is kind of cool when they have a common character, because then there's like accountability to the character and stuff. So I ended up finding on Netflix there was like a BBC 4-part dramatization-y thing about Ian Fleming. So I watched that. Because I was like so fiend.
That's recent, right?
I don't know how recent it is. I think Iron Man's dad played Ian Fleming.
Yeah,
I think
that came out like last year, actually.
Yeah, it had some good bits, but it was
it chose to be
a lot more about like him pursuing this woman and a lot less about like sort of the more innovative spy stuff that he was kind of thinking of, which was what I wanted to see. I want to see the spy stuff, but they had some of that, and in bits of it, it almost felt like with the production value and everything. Like it was, like they were doing the reenactment parts of like one of those bio documentary type things, you know. It was almost on that level.
Speaking of Iron Man's dad, are you gonna watch Agent Carter?
Yeah, it's it probably recorded already. The first 2-parter.
It's getting good reviews.
I've kept up with the Marvel stuff so far.
I have no interest, but Hayley Atwell's super hot.
Well, you'll like episode 1 of the second season of Black Mirror, then.
Is she naked in it?
She's in it.
Is she naked in it?
It's like a TV show. They don't show nudity, really. Even on BBC stuff.
Yeah, they do.
Not really.
Don't you remember when Mr. Darcy's shirt was open?
Right, I forgot about this.
Yes.
In 95 they did. They've gotten a little more conservative, I guess. A little more
he's asking about her parents.
Buttoned up. Right. You love that.
That's hot. That's hot. Sexy, dude. He's stammering. Just, oh man, how do I cover up my... First of all...
Inappropriate.
His couple of chest hairs that are showing. How do I cover that up, you know? You can't. Mm-hmm. You can't.
Right.
His shirt's wet. You can almost see his nips. Nip slip.
Yeah, good point. Anyway, yeah, so that was my sort of the spy espionage thing. I kind of had some fun with some of that stuff. Just gotten
into sports. Stuff.
Yeah, I did too. One of the guys on the Film Junk podcast, Sean, is really into that stuff. And so he mentioned something on Twitter, and I asked him. And he mentioned another one, which was also it's got James Mason and stuff. I think it's another Le Carré story. That's on Amazon, but it's another one that's not free. So I've got it in my watch list, and I keep being like, I just don't want to get sucked down the rabbit hole. I've already done that twice. If you go for the HD, it's like the same as like the old school days of renting a new movie, like $4.
Really?
Yeah, and you're like to rent it, and then it ends up being a bit more. I mean, it is if you're going to do it a lot. Like when we watched Color of Money, which we can talk about in a minute. I was like, fuck it. And we, I'm like, let's just do that. Like, I just wanted to watch it. And they had the Hobbit cartoon. And I'm like, I just am in the mood to watch this. So I indulged myself with those two times. But that's not something I want to, like I said, fall into the rabbit hole of. Because they have quite a bit of stuff, quite a lot of stuff there. But that's just how they get you. You know, you're already paying for a service. And then you pay for it again. And then you pay, you know, it's going to get ridiculous. None of that. I'll just wait. I remember like when I first got Amazon Prime, they had Under the Skin on there, and I'm like, oh man, like, but maybe I'll wait. And then like a week later, it was like on Prime for free. So it was.
Sometimes it pans out.
Yeah, and that one was weird. That one was that one was okay. I don't know. It was cool, but kind of strange. I'm interested to see the new Ghost in the Shell movie, I guess, because Scarlett Johansson's going to be Motoko Kusanagi. I wonder if they'll change her name or how that'll work.
Live action Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah, directed by the guy that did Snow White and the Huntsman, so woohoo for that, right? You'd think it'd be such a no-brainer to get someone like I don't know.
Your boy.
Which one?
Jendy.
Well, no, he wouldn't be right for that. Either Blomkamp or like someone like Nicholas Winding Refn.
Blomkamp is very, by this point, the two movies, he's just heavy-handed.
He can be, but that new one looks fun.
Oh, here's my point.
I know, but the one with the one the next one he's doing looks good. I want to watch it. Have you seen that trailer for it?
No, I don't watch TV.
You don't see trailers for movies on TV.
Where do you see them? I don't have the internet either.
If you don't have the, well, then that's also that. But I know you sometimes have the internet. I know you try to keep up. Anyway, that one looks fun.
I only read Proust.
Right. That's okay. Well, then like Nicholas Winding Refn would have been good for the guy to drive. For Ghost in the Shell remake, because he's got the color schemes and stuff that look cool that would fit for like an anime adaptation.
He's also
adaptation.
Very meandery,
which Ghost in the Shell is.
But it's not like time wasting meandering.
No, but he would be focused. The plot would force him to focus it a little more, and he wouldn't be as meandery. I didn't think Only God Forgives or whatever was very good. I didn't like that.
It was too meandering.
Yeah, exactly. But Drive was good.
Drive was pretty good. It was too meandering.
It worked with the story, I think. I'm not a fan of meandering. You know that. I will often dock things and be like, this should have been 10 minutes shorter. I'll be that petty about it. Or whatever. But, yeah, so.
I watched First Blood the other night.
With Dennehy?
Yeah.
Nice. And Caruso?
Caruso.
I was forgetting. Is Caruso the one that goes off, falls out of the helicopter and dies?
No, that's the dickwad downstairs with the mustache who he's like Dennehy's right hand man.
Yeah, he is.
But he goes a little nutty because Rambo shows him what's up down below.
Yeah.
And so then when he's following them, you know, they tell the guy to come in the helicopter and he's like, he won't do it. And Dennehy's like, you make him do it, or, you know, I'll find something to book him for, you know, just stuff like that all the time, the helicopter guy. But then after the dude falls out of the helicopter, he's like, I'm out of here, I'm not dealing with this anymore. So he leaves.
Yeah. What made you want to rewatch First Blood? I feel like that's something people have seen recently. Or it was a big when the new one came out here a couple months, years ago.
I haven't watched it in a long time. It's good. You know, the interesting thing about, like, and this wasn't even one that he had anything to do with, but I think maybe he learned from First Blood or something, because he wrote Rocky before First Blood, right?
Right.
He was born
in
79. But like, the things he's written and directed, like, you know, since he wrote the first Rocky, like, he's tight. He's a tight, you know, everything is like, you know, it gets to the point, it lays everything out really quick, you know, and
might throw in a scene with people playing basketball or something, though.
Maybe, throwing knives.
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know who it was, some comedian, I retweeted it. He goes, all the airplanes in Top Gun were real because they blew their CGI budget on making us believe Tom Cruise could spike a bomb.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I saw that.
Anyway, like, it's, I don't know, there's just like, you know, it just gets, and I remembered First Blood being like, oh, this is a slower one.
It's kind of a bummer, too.
But it's a bummer, for sure, but it's not slower. It moves really quick. It really
Pretty
quickly
quick,
gets
buddy.
To the point. It really quickly gets to the
I
point.
I think it just starts, very soberly and somberly.
It starts soberly, yeah.
And that, in that sense, it seems like it takes a little longer to go, because, like, they pick him up, and then they drag him to the jail, and then they're hosing him off and kind of berating him.
Yeah,
and then he gets out, and then it sort of, it escalates. So in that,
quickly,
yeah, it does pretty quickly. But there is a couple down moments once he's in this awesome scene.
So it starts with a shot of him walking down the road, right? And he gets into this town, and the first thing he does is walk up to the lady looking for his buddy, and the lady's putting clothes on the line. There's a kid there, and he asks for her. It's a great scene. He asks for his buddy. She says he's not here, and he asks a few more questions, and this is the only time the movie seems bright and chipper and happy.
I don't think she ever looks at him either.
No, she does. She looks at him, and he shows her a picture of all of them. They're in the same platoon, all the stuff, and he said he told me if I ever needed a job or a place to stay, like, to look him up, you know, he was my good buddy, and she basically tells him he died of, you know,
Agent Orange
cancer
or something.
Cancer
that kind of
due
stuff,
to
yeah.
Agent Orange, yeah, and Stallone was Stallone. You know, Stallone can be a really good actor. He really can, and he has this great thing where, like, he can't look at her anymore after that, and he kind of hands her the picture like this, and then turns around and walks away, and then she shows emotion for the first time when she takes the picture and looks at it. It's just like a good Hollywood scene in a movie, and it's just,
well, it's still throwing back to, like, those. I mean, you talk about Hollywood, but that's still 70s Hollywood. That's still cynical Hollywood.
It was the whole Easy Riders region.
Right, yeah, thing. And
thing, yeah.
And so, like, those influencers are still there in bits, in little
and
bits.
And you know, what's funny about the movie is that the one thing that's jarring in it is Troutman. Because Richard Crenna, like, his acting is like Saturday afternoon TV movie acting, and everyone else, like Dennehy, like towers over him acting wise. Everyone acts circles around Crenna. Krenna's like throwing his head around.
Well, but he's also
like choppily says stuff, and
he's also,
like,
supposed to be like
and
this
go-to
is that,
like,
guy.
The First Blood is like the outlier in the series because
right.
the rest are just wacky, you know, stupid, violent action
I'm
movies.
Coming to get you.
And so he's like the link. To them, you know, like,
yeah, oh, for sure. He pulls it, he literally pulls him back in
yeah.
the second one,
yeah.
Co-written by Dad, screenplay by James Cameron. First Blood Part 2,
yeah. No, as I was watching it, I was like, this is one of those movie title things I hate, which is that First Blood Part 2 is Rambo,
yeah,
it's Rambo First Blood Part 2, that's what its actual title is. And then the third one's called Rambo 3. But there is no Rambo 2. There's right. First Blood Part 2, which is just called Rambo. First Blood, the second one's technically just called Rambo, with the subtitle First Blood Part 2. And there's Rambo 3. And then Rambo 4 is Rambo.
Isn't
Again.
It John Rambo? Did they give him a first name?
I think the fifth one's John Rambo.
Oh, the one they're working on still?
Yeah.
What is that even going to do?
I don't know.
No, really, what is that going to do?
No,
he went home.
He's going to kill a bunch of people.
He went home.
I think he walks into his door in a front door, and some cattle thieves killed his dad.
You think so? Some rustlers. Some backwoods rustlers? You think Shaggy 2 Dope and Violent Shaggy J are right there?
Violent J snuck into his dad's Arizona ranch and slit his throat.
Oh, man.
And I love the idea that, like, as the older Stallone gets, the less likely it is that his dad is alive.
Oh, yeah. That's like, not even
because back in the day, possible. People didn't have kids when they were 20. Yeah. They had kids when they were like 38, especially if you were old enough to be in the Vietnam War. So
right.
Stallone is like 70 now. That means his dad's got to be like 104.
Who knows?
Who's it going to be? It's got to be Duvall, right? Robert Duvall has to be his dad, doesn't he?
Or Robert Redford?
Too young looking. They're like the same age.
Yeah.
Nah, Redford's 80, I want to say, isn't he, by now?
Probably. I mean, they're all up there. Maybe Shatner.
Maybe Shaq.
Shaq could be
Shaquille O'Neal.
I'm sorry, John. What are you doing? Get y'all well up.
I didn't keep in touch, John.
You want some gold ball Medicaid powder? It'd help you out.
There you go. Yeah, nice, good. Keep it, you know.
Keep it topical.
Keep it modern.
Keep it topical.
That's good. Icy hot.
Icy hot. I'm glad that Shaq is successfully doing
it. I'm glad he's has $800 million.
Why not?
Good for Shaq.
Good for Shaq.
Good for Shaq for being born with gigantism, you know, that paid his way through life.
And making it work for him. Yeah. So first blood that came together. Those are some fun ones. What are you looking forward to in 2015? Now we've talked up and down 2014.
I'm psyched about Mad Max. I'm psyched about Star Wars. I'm trying not to be, but I am, and I'm going to be disappointed.
What makes you think you'll be disappointed? Just the fact that it...
Because J.J. Abrams is necessarily better than Lucas. So George Lucas is someone who you hope he could reach the heights he hit before.
Right.
Which were really good.
Yeah.
And not necessarily when he ever directed, but there right. is at least one movie he directed that... seems like the work of a good director, which is American Graffiti. And
right.
And it's not childish.
No.
It's done really well. So, and it's like cinema verite, like it's slice of life stuff, you know.
American Graffiti is a classic.
It is. It really is. And he touched on things, and then as a producer and an idea man, just great stuff. So I feel like his ceiling, which we never really got to see, was very high. This is the, I'm going to use sports terms here. His ceiling is very high.
But then
his
what?
His floor
yeah.
is spectacularly low.
Yeah.
J.J. Abrams.
Sub-basements.
J.J. Abrams has a very high floor. So you're not going to get severely disappointed.
Right.
I don't think his ceiling is very high. I think you have a decent wheelhouse.
This is very good. I think you need to do this more for movies because it makes it very clear when you're talking something as abstract as art, when you relate it to something as kind of visually relatable as just like an athletic accomplishment. I mean, if the guy can hit, he can hit.
I'm talking about like basketball draft picks, and you can tell by scouts can tell on the statistics.
Well, it's just performance
in their sports. It's like, well, not necessarily just performance because the bodies will develop in the and so when you're looking at a prospect for a sport, they talk a lot about what you believe a ceiling or a floor is.
Right.
And I just think that Abrams can't really be bad.
But he can't be
but
that great.
He can't be spectacular. Like, the best he's really been as a director is what?
I think the best he's been as a director has mostly been... I think his stories all have the same problem, which is something that maybe he doesn't consider a problem, which is the magic box bullshit.
I don't think he's doing any writing, man.
It doesn't even really matter, but he's kind of related to like the kinds of things. And it probably won't relate to Star Wars at all. I think one of the best things he's ever directed, actually, was I think a season 3 episode of Alias that had a seriously, like, almost as good, if not maybe better, than the Kill Bill kitchen fight scene in it. Mm. It was a kitchen fight scene in that was really good. And I was like, this is amazing for, like, television that they did this.
He directed that episode.
He directed that episode. It was one of the last ones he wrote and directed, I think. It was like the finale of season 3 or something like that. Alias was pretty good. It was like a spy show. I like spy shows, whatever. I didn't care that much for Super 8. The Star Wars movies I thought have been fun, but, you know, or Star Trek movies, but yeah.
The first one was pretty good.
I completely agree with you that you're right. I mean, there's no... I think because even for me, and this goes to show how much of an old school Star Wars guy I am and an old school Indiana Jones guy, you know, you got Spielberg, you got Lucas. If Lucas were doing it, part of me would be more excited because, like you said, that high ceiling. You'd be like, it'd be his redemption, you know? Right. Like, it would be like, he's going to come back and he's going to blow these... Instead of it being this weird kind of like... And then they talk about, like, Rian Johnson. And it's like, Looper was okay and Brick was really good. But I don't know that... I mean, just... It's turning into, like, now it's the nerds that grew up on the stuff. And even if they want to do it justice, can they ever do anything other than kind of parody it? You almost need someone that's removed from it. Which is why I'm excited about Kasdan at least being involved in the screenwriting. Because he's, like... You know, he was there at the beginning... And he was the one sort of infusing things into Empire, probably, and into Jedi, you know, back when Lucas wasn't completely
gone. He's an old school Hollywood screenwriter, right, also. Yeah. And that's before the day of people just following the Robert McKee rules, like the really, really tight rules, like your stupid save the cat thing.
But would you act like that's just all me or something?
It is. You wrote and directed and published Save the Cat.
R.I.P., huh?
Yeah, and Abrams, normal guys, Kurtzman and Orzy and Lindelof and all those guys, are just purely by the book 100%.
Yeah.
Page by page.
Because exactly it's blockbustery stuff.
Supposed to happen, so.
And like you say, it ends up being...
He's never made anything that isn't purely 100% paint by numbers commercial.
Yeah.
And Star Wars has... hugely commercial, but it's never ever been paint by numbers commercial.
Right,
that's one of the things about it. It's been spectacular.
It's kind of like those Marvel movies in some
it's
ways.
It's been really bad at times, yeah. But very creatively so. Yeah. You know, like
well, no, it's, but it's like the Marvel thing. You talk about the crowd pleasing nature, something like Guardians of the Galaxy, and like you know, there's paint by numbers aspects to that too. Yeah. But there's also some weird, cool, clever decisions right. made there as well. And it's like
paint by numbers is fine if it's done modestly,
right?
But like. The paint by numbers that's like you throw a garish director on top of some paint by numbers writing and then you're just like you're flashed and dazzled by it and afterwards you're like that's every movie I've ever seen in
yeah.
the last 10 years.
You're kind of like you wonder like did they really care? At least Christopher Nolan cares, you know, or seems to or whatever, he's trying to elevate things. Yeah, I agree. I'm not that's what scares me about it, I guess. Visually, it looks like they. I mean, that's also kind of like the weird opposite thing. The irony of how good that first teaser trailer is with all the like visuals. That it's almost like, what can we do to make everybody excited? And like, why don't we just show stuff that no one has ever thought of putting in a Star Wars movie before? We'll just have a guy walking in the snow. Snow? Has there been? Yeah, there was snow in Hoth. What about trees and snow? No, I don't think there's ever been a goddamn. What about Dagobah? Kind of, sort of, but not swamps. What about like X-Wings? Yeah, there's been X-Wings. What if we put him on like atmosphere? You mean like flying through sky? No, we mean like flying on water. You're like, okay, so we'll do that. What about a robot that's like rolling around? You know, you just give all these people these visual gimmicks and all that, and like if they're that connects to a really awesome story, that'll be great. If not, it will just be a really cool trailer to a mediocre movie.
I'm interested to see. I've talked to a few people about this. Lucas particularly is a very terms of direction, like there's almost no camp. Well, not I can't say that for sure, but he really likes his set shots.
Right.
And
he's old school. He's an old school like
things. You know, things roll into scenes. And J.J. Abrams is a guy who really likes to have the camera moving at all times.
And with the lens flaring and the shit.
Yeah, I think he's supposed to tone that down. But like in terms of moving and stuff, I'm afraid to see like.
They frame differently.
Following people as they run up over a hill, then the camera moves up over them and sees something happening. I don't want to see that in a Star Wars movie. I want to see someone do what Lucas did, but way better.
Right.
That's what I want to see.
You just want to see. You want to see THX 1138 Lucas direct these movies. That's what I want to see because that that's my favorite like visual direction from Lucas. I think. I mean, I love American Graffiti. But I think like you get a great sense of just his framing and things in THX 1138 because it's so sparse in places. It's just like there's like just an awesome shot of like a race car-y car like just peeling out and like hitting these things, and it's just like cool looking. And I remember as a kid seeing that like on TV and being like, that's awesome looking, like before you were inundated with car commercial stuff, and David Fincher came in and did his David Fincher thing with everything and all that. But yeah, so I don't know that one. Yeah, Mad Max, I'm gonna try to go in as blind as I can. I think if anyone can do it right, I think Hardy can do it right. In that first trailer, they showed like all the like, what looked like a lot of practical stuff, or at least very convincing CG, you know, out in the desert doing it for real. George Miller
is all that matters.
Right? Yeah. I think you know, there's that moment you see Max and he gives that little like smirk smile thing that he does, and it's like Tom Hardy's like got the Max smirk smile, which means he's got like the Max mentality, and that's all you need. If you can do that, and you got George Miller, and then you can throw in some fun zany stuff, then it'll be great. I just don't know whether they're gonna feel like they have to crank it to 22 in order to make it be the proper Mad Max sequel, and then it will just play too cartoony, and it'll feel like a Tank Girl sequel or something, you know? And be like, I don't want to see the Tank Girl sequel for the next Mad Max movie, you know?
No thanks.
Yeah, no thanks. Thanks, but no thanks. And then I don't know. I'm pretty.
I wouldn't mind Ice-T being in Mad Max.
That would be cool. Yeah, no, I give you that. He could just come in and explain stuff and talk about things. Are you telling me nobody has gasoline in this whole town? Yeah, that would be good. Yeah, I was looking at the AV Club thing, and they were talking about all the stuff they're looking forward to. And I don't know if there's still another post for the article or whatever, but there wasn't a lot of movies that were like big, cool movies, I guess. Who knows? I'm kind of wondering when Marvel's going to have its first movie misstep. It might be Ant-Man.
I haven't even seen that trailer.
I haven't seen the trailer yet, but I just think...
Paul Rudd can't go wrong.
Yeah, but Ant-Man is such an intrinsically kind of goofy, dumb thing that I'm nervous that they lost their big kind of weird nerd draw with what's his name leaving. The director.
How about the Hot Fuzz guy?
Hot Fuzz guy, yeah.
Who ended up finishing it?
I don't know. I don't even think it wasn't even finishing. It was like it actually Kubrick. Made it. Yeah, Stanley Kubrick did it.
Spartacus.
Posthumously, yeah. So I don't know. Actually, their first misstep might be, it won't not make money, but I wonder if the second Avengers movie will be like a second Iron Man kind of equivalent. I don't know how Angry Robot translates to something big enough to get all these people together, you know?
Let's see.
Oh, you find some list of all kinds of stuff that's coming out or something?
No, I'm just looking at who actually ended up directing. Peyton Reed. Oh, Peyton Reed's okay.
What's he done?
Bring It On.
Oh, okay.
A bunch more than that. That's why I know him from.
You know him from Bring It On, huh?
Yeah, I like Peyton Reed. He did Down With Love, The Breakup, Yes Man.
What? These all sound like really...
It's all comedies.
Yeah, but nothing that great.
Bring It On is great.
I've only seen bits of it on TV. It's good satire. Is it another Shakespeare adaptation?
No, it's just good. Bring It On is good, really good. Did you ever see Fired Up?
No, you've told me multiple times that's actually pretty good.
That's really funny, yeah. And there's a scene in that at this cheerleader camp where all the kids, it's mostly girls and a handful of like gay guys.
Right.
And they're all sitting out on this lawn at night watching, like it's their like, you know, summer movie thing, and they're just watching Bring It On. And the joke is that like it's several hundred kids, like, you know, high schoolers sitting on the grass, and each one of them is religiously saying out loud every single line.
Oh my god.
As it's happening from the movie. It's pretty funny.
That would sound creepy though too, right?
It kind of is, yeah. And some of them run.
Like they were at some kind of a church or something.
There's some good stuff in it.
Yeah, the new P.T. Anderson will be fun to check out. I'll still be playing catch up on a lot of old stuff. I still haven't seen, like, Spike Jonze's last movie, Her.
There's some stuff where, like, even if I know it's going to be good, I just have to force myself to do it. And
I've had Enemy on Amazon Prime since I got it, and I've been wanting to check it out. I just haven't.
When I force myself to watch something, I wanted to see Nightcrawler, and then the more I learned about Nightcrawler, I was like, maybe I don't want to see that.
Right.
And then I forced myself to see it, and I was like, this was great.
Yeah, it usually is. It's like we got Wolf of Wall Street. We'll check that out sometime.
Bill Paxton's in it.
Is it Nightcrawler? Yeah. Oh, that sounds good. Is he full Paxton?
He's full Paxton.
Well, all right, then.
Yeah. And then he, his lines are basically consist of him cursing out and belittling people.